down at the man he'd knifed. There was no doubt that he was dead. His handsome Slavic face was contorted with surprise and pain, and his uniform blouse was soaked black with blood. The eyes might have been marbles for all the life they contained.
"You okay, ma'am?" Rogers asked, briefly turning his head around.
Edward saw her for the second time, sprawled out on the wooden floor. A pretty girl, her woolen nightdress torn apart, barely covering one breast, and the rest of her pale body, already red and bruised in several places, exposed for all to see. Beyond her in the kitchen, Edward saw the unmoving legs of another woman. He went into the room and saw a dog and a man, also dead. Each body displayed a single red circle in the chest. Smith came in. He looked around the room, then at Edwards. The wimp had fangs.
"I'll check the upstairs. Heads up, skipper."
Rogers kicked the Russian down to the floor and placed his bayonet point in the small of his back.
"You move and I'll fucking cut you in half," the private snarled.
Edward stooped down to the blonde girl. Her face was puffing up from blows to the jaw and cheek, her breath coming in shudders. He guessed her age at 20 or so. Her nightdress was destroyed. Edwards looked around and, pulling the cloth off the dining room table, draped it over her.
"You okay? Come on, you're alive, honey. You're safe. You're okay now."
Her eyes seemed pointed in different directions at first. Then they focused and came over to the young lieutenant. Edwards cringed to see the look in them. His hand touched her cheek as gently as he could.
"Come on. Let's get you up off the floor. Nobody's going to hurt you. Not now."
She started shaking so violently that it seemed the whole house would join her. He helped her up, careful to wrap the tablecloth all around her.
"Come on."
"Upstairs is clear, sir," Smith returned, holding a robe.
"You want to put this on the lady? They do anything else to her?"
"Killed her mom and dad. And a dog. I imagine they were going to do her, too, when they got finished. Sarge, get things organized. Search the Russians. Get some food, anything else that looks useful. Move quick, Jim. Lots of things we got to do. You have a first aid pack?"
"Right, skipper. Here."
Smith tossed him a small package of bandages and antiseptics, then went back out the door to check on Garcia.
"Let's get you upstairs and cleaned off."
Edwards wrapped his left arm around her shoulders and helped her up the steep old wooden steps. His heart went out to the girl. She had china blue eyes, obscenely empty of life, though even now they caught the light in a way certain to attract any man's attention. As they just had, Edwards thought. She was only an inch shorter than he, with pale, almost transparent skin. Her figure was marred by a slight bulge at the abdomen, and Mike had a good idea what that was. The rest of her figure was so perfect. And she'd just been raped by one Russian, paving the way for a long night of it, Mike Edwards thought, enraged that once more this foul crime had touched his life. There was a small room at the top of the twisting stairs. She entered it and sat on the single bed.
"Who?"
she stammered in accented English.
"We're Americans. We escaped from Keflavik when the Russians attacked."
"What's your name?"
"Vigdis Augustdottir."
The slightest sign of life in her voice. Vigdis, the daughter of August, dead in the kitchen. He wondered what Vigdis meant, sure that it wasn't pretty enough. He set the hurricane lamp on the night table and broke open the pack. Her skin was broken along the jawline, and he swabbed disinfectant there. It had to hurt, but the girl didn't wince at all. The rest of her he'd seen was just bruised, maybe some scrapes on her back from the hardwood floor. She'd fought hard to defend herself and taken a dozen punches. And certainly she was no virgin. Just a bloodied face.
It could have been far worse, but Edwards's rage continued to grow. Such a pretty face desecrated. Well, he'd already reached that decision.
You can't stay here. We have to leave soon. You'll have to leave, too.
But...
I'm sorry. I understand. I mean, when the Russians attacked, I lost some friends, too. Not the same as your mom and dad, but...
Jesus!
Edwards's hands shook in frustration as he stumbled through the meaningless words.
I'm sorry we didn't get here sooner.
What is it that some of the feminists say? That rape is the crime that all men use to subjugate all women? Then why do you want to go downstairs and...
Edwards knew that something almost as satisfying was in the works.
He took her hand, and she didn't resist.
We're going to have to leave. We'll take you anywhere we can. You must have family around here, or friends.
We'll take you to them, and they can take care of you.
But you can't stay here.
If you stay here, you're sure to get killed. Do you understand?
He saw her head nod jerkily in the shadows.
Yes, please. Please leave me alone. I must be alone for a little.
Okay.
He touched her cheek again. If you need anything, call us.
Edwards went back downstairs. Smith had taken charge. There were three men on their knees, blindfolded, gagged, and hands tied behind their backs. Garcia was standing over them. Rogers was in the kitchen. Smith was sorting through a pile of stuff on the table.
Okay, what do we got here?
Smith regarded his officer with something akin to affection.
Well, sir, we got us a Russian lieutenant with a wet dick, a dead sergeant, a dead private, and two live ones. The lieutenant had this, sir.
Edwards took the map and unfolded it.
Damn, ain't that nice?
The map was covered with scribbled markings.
We got another set of binoculars, a radio. Shame we can't use that. Some rations. Looks like shit, but better than nothing. We done good, Skipper. Bag five Russians with three rounds expended.
What do we need to take, Jim?
Just food, sir. I mean, we could take a couple of their rifles, and that'd double up our ammo load, you know. But we're already loaded pretty heavy.
And we aren't here to fight a war, just to play scout.
Right.
I think we ought to take some clothes, sweaters and like that.
We taking the lady with us?
Have to.
Smith nodded.
Yeah, makes sense. Hope she likes walking, sir. Looks like she's in decent shape, except for being pregnant. 4 months, I'd say.
Pregnant?
Garcia turned.
Raping a pregnant girl?
He muttered something in Spanish.
Any of them say anything? Mike asked.
Not a word, sir, Garcia answered. Jim, take a look at the girl, and get her down here. Her name's Vigdis. Easy on her.
Don't worry, sir.
Smith went upstairs.
The lieutenant's the one with it hanging out, right?
Garcia nodded, and Edwards went around to face him. He had to remove the gag and blindfold. The man was his own age. He was sweating.
You speak English?
The man shook his head.
Spreche Deutsch.
Edwards had taken 2 years of German in high school, but suddenly found himself unwilling to talk with this man. He had already decided to kill him, and he didn't wish to speak with someone he was about to kill. It might bother his conscience. Edwards didn't want his conscience to remember this. But he watched the man for a minute or two, examining what sort of person would do what he had done. He expected to discover something monstrous, but didn't. He looked up. Smith was leading Vigdis down the stairs.
"She's got good gear, Skipper. Nice warm clothes. Her boots are all broke in. I expect we can get her a canteen, a parka, and a field pack. I'd let her bring a brush and girl stuff, sir. I'll get her some soap, too, and maybe a razor."
"Way to go, Sergeant."
"Vigdis,"
Edwards said, getting her attention.
We will be leaving soon. He turned to look back down at the Russian.
Leutnant?
Wofür?
Warum?
What for? Why did you do all this?
Not for me, for her.
The man knew what was coming. He shrugged.
Afghanistan.
Skipper, they're prisoners, Rogers blurted.
I mean, sir, you can't...
Gentlemen, you are charged under Uniform Code of Military Justice with one specification of rape and two specifications of murder.
These are capital crimes, Edward said, mainly so that he could assuage his conscience for the other two.
Do you have anything to say in your defense?
No.
You are found guilty. Your sentence is death. With his left hand, Edwards pushed the lieutenant's head back. His right hand flipped the knife into the air, reversing it. Then he swung it viciously, striking the man's larynx with the pommel. The sound was surprisingly loud in the room, and Edwards kicked him backward. A terrible thing to watch, it lasted several minutes. The lieutenant's larynx was instantly fractured, and its swelling blocked his trachea. Unable to breathe, his torso bucked from side to side as his face darkened. Everyone in the room who could see watched. If any felt pity for the man, none showed it. Finally, he stopped moving.
I'm sorry we weren't faster, Vigdis, but this thing won't be hurting anyone else.
Edwards hoped that his amateur psychiatry would work. The girl went back upstairs, probably to wash, he thought. He'd read that after being raped, one thing women wanted to do was bathe, as though there were a visible stigma from being the victim of an animal's lust. He turned toward the remaining two. There was no way they could manage prisoners, and what they had been up to merely provided him with a good excuse. But these two hadn't hurt the girl yet, and...
I'll take care of it, sir, Garcia said quietly.
The private was standing behind the kneeling prisoners. One of them was making some noise, but even if he hadn't been gagged, none of the Americans knew a word of Russian. They had no chance at all. Garcia stabbed from the side, sticking his knife completely through one neck, then the other. Both men fell. It was over quickly. The private and the lieutenant went into the kitchen to wash their hands.
Okay, we load them back into the 4x4 and drive it back to the main road. We'll see if we can fake an accident and torch the vehicle. Get some liquor bottles. We'll make it look like they were drinking.
They were, sir. Rogers held up a bottle of clear liquor. Edwards gave the bottle a brief look, but shook off the thought.
Figures. If I guess right, these guys were the crossroads guards from the main highway. Or maybe just a patrol. I don't think they can guard every crossroads on this island. If we're just a little lucky, maybe their bosses will never figure out we were involved in this.
A long shot, he thought, but what the hell?
Skipper, Smith said.
If you want to do that, we gotta...
I know.
You and Rogers stay here and get ready. If you see anything else we can use, pack it up. When we get back, we'll have to haul ass.
Edwards and Garcia loaded all the bodies into the back of the truck, careful to sort through the battle gear. They unloaded waterproof parkas, whose camouflage pattern was almost identical with their own, and a few other items that wouldn't be missed, then drove off quickly down the road. Luck was with them. There was no permanent guard post at the crossroads, perhaps because the farm road led nowhere. The Russians had probably been a patrol team, and had chosen the farm for a little informal R&R. 200 yards down the coastal highway, the road paralleled a steep cliff. They halted the vehicle there and manhandled the bodies into the seats. Garcia emptied a jerry can of gasoline into the back, and the two men pushed it toward the edge with the rear hatch open. Garcia tossed a Russian grenade into the back as it went over the edge. Neither man wanted to admire their handiwork. They ran back the half mile to the farmhouse. Everything was ready.
"We have to burn the house, Miss Vigdis," Smith was explaining. "If we don't, the Russians'll know for sure what happened here. Your mom and dad are dead, ma'am, but I'm sure they'd want you to stay alive, okay?" She was still too much in shock to offer more than token resistance. Rogers and Smith had cleaned off the bodies and moved them upstairs to their own bedroom. It would have been better to bury them, but there just wasn't time. "Let's get moving, people," Edwards ordered. They should have been moving already. Somebody had to be coming to investigate the burning truck, and if they used a chopper. "Garcia, watch the lady. Smith has the rear. Rogers, take the point. We have to put 6 miles between us and this place in the next 3 hours." Smith waited 10 minutes before tossing his grenade into the house. The kerosene he'd spread on the first floor went up at once. USS Chicago. The contact was a lot better now. They had classified one ship as a Kashin-class missile destroyer, and her propeller blade count indicated a speed of 21 knots. The leading elements of the Soviet formation were now 37 miles away. There seemed to be two groups, the leading formation fanned out and screening the second. McCafferty ordered the ESM mast raised. It showed lots of activity, but he expected that. Upscope. The quartermaster worked the operating ring, then snapped the handles into place and stepped back. McCafferty swept the horizon quickly. After 10 seconds, he flipped the handles up, and the periscope was instantly lowered back into its well. "It's going to be a busy day, troops," the captain said. He always let the attack center crew know as much of what was going on as possible. The more they knew, the better they could do their jobs. "I saw a pair of bare Fs, one due north, the other west. Both a good way off, but you can bet they're dropping sonoboys. XO, take her back down to 500 feet, speed 5 knots. We'll let them come to us." "Con, sonar."
"Con, aye," McCafferty answered. "We got some pingers, active sonoboys to the northwest. We count 6 of them, all very faint."
The sonar chief read off the bearings to the signal sources. "Still no active sonar signals coming from the target formation, sir."
"Very well."
McCafferty returned the mic to its holder. Chicago's depth was changing quickly as they dove at a 15-degree angle. He watched the bathythermograph readout. At 220 feet, the water temperature began to drop rapidly, changing 12 degrees inside of 70 feet. "Good. A strong layer to hide under. And cold water deep to allow good sonar performance for his own sensors." 2 hours before, he had removed the torpedo from one of his tubes and replaced it with a Harpoon missile. It gave him only one torpedo ready for instant use if he found a submarine target, but a salvo of 3 missiles available to fling at surface ships, plus his Tomahawks. He could fire either now and expect hits, but McCafferty didn't want to fire at just anything. There was no sense wasting a missile on a small patrol craft when there was a cruiser and a carrier out there waiting for him. He wanted to identify specific targets first. It wouldn't be easy, but he knew that easy things didn't have to be done by the 688-class subs. He went forward into sonar. The chief caught him out of the corner of his eye.
"Skipper, I may have a bearing to Kirov. I just copied 6 pings from a low-frequency sonar. I think that's him, bearing 039. Trying to isolate his engine signature now. And if... okay, some more sonoboys are dropping to the right."
The display showed new points of light well to the right of the first string, and a sizable gap between the two.
"Think he's dropping them in chevrons, chief?" McCafferty asked.
He got a smile and a nod for an answer. If the Soviets were deploying their sonoboys in angled lines left and right of the formation, that could mean that their ships were heading right for Chicago. The submarine would not have to maneuver at all to intercept them. She could stay as quiet as an open grave.
They seem to be alternating them above and below the layer, sir. A pretty fair gap between them, too. The chief lit a cigarette without averting his eyes from the screen. The ashtray next to him was crammed with butts.
We'll plot that one out. Good work, Bernie.
The captain patted his sonar chief on the shoulder and went back to the attack center. The fire control tracking party was already plotting the new contacts. It looked like an interval of just over 2 miles between the sonoboys. If the Soviets were alternating them above and below the layer, there was a good chance he could sneak between a pair. The other question was the presence of passive boys, whose presence he could not detect. McCafferty stood at the periscope pedestal, watching his men at work as they entered data into the fire control computers, backed up by other men with paper plots and handheld calculators. The weapons control panel was lit up by indicators showing ready. The submarine was at battle stations.
Take her up to 200 feet. We'll listen above the layer for a few minutes.
The maneuver paid off at once.
I got direct path to the targets, the sonar chief announced.
They could now detect and track sound energy radiating directly from the Soviet ships, without depending on the on-again, off-again convergence zones. McCafferty commanded himself to relax. He'd soon have work enough.
Captain, we're about due for another sonoboy drop. They've been averaging about every 15 minutes, and this one might be close.
Getting that horse-jaw sonar again, sir, sonar warned. Bearing 320 at this time. Signal weak. Classify this contact as the cruiser Kirov.
Stand by.
Another one. We have a medium-frequency active sonar bearing 331, maneuvering left to right. We classify this contact as a Cresta II ASW cruiser.
I think he's right, the plotting officer said.
Bearing 320 is close to our bearings for a pair of screen ships, but far enough off that it's probably a different contact. 331 is consistent with the center screen ship.
It figures.
The Cresta will be the screen commander, with the flagship a ways behind him. Need some time to work out the ranges, though. The captain ordered his submarine to stay above the layer, able to duck beneath it in seconds. The tactical display was evolving now. He had a workable bearing on Kirov, almost good enough to shoot on, though he still needed range data. There seemed to be a pair of escorts between him and the cruiser, and unless he had a proper range estimate, any missile he launched at the Soviet flagship might attack a destroyer or frigate by mistake. In the interim, the solution on the attack director set the harpoons to fly straight for what he believed to be the battlecruiser Kirov. Chicago began to zigzag left and right of her course track. As the submarine changed her position, the bearing to her sonar contacts changed also. The tracking party could use the submarine's own course deviation as a baseline to compute ranges to the various contacts. A straightforward process, essentially an exercise in high school trigonometry, it nevertheless took time because they had to estimate the speed and course of the moving targets. Even computer support couldn't make the process go much faster. And one of his quartermasters took great pride in his ability to use a circular slide rule and race the computer to a hard solution. The tension seemed to grow by degrees. Then it plateaued. The years of training were paying off. Data was handled, plotted, and acted upon in seconds. The crew suddenly seemed a physical part of the gear they were operating. Their feelings shut off, their emotions submerged, only the sweat on their foreheads betraying that they were men after all, and not machines. They depended absolutely on their sonar operators. Sound energy was their only indication of what was happening, and each new bearing report triggered furious activity. It was clear that their targets were zigzagging, which made the range computations even more difficult.
Con, sonar. Active sonoboy close aboard to port. Below the layer, I think.
Right full rudder. All ahead two-thirds, the executive officer ordered instantly.
McCafferty went to sonar and plugged in a set of headphones. The pings were loud, but distorted, he thought. If the buoy was below the temperature gradient, the signals radiating upward would be unable to detect his submarine.
Probably.
Signal strength? He asked.
Strong, the chief replied. Even money they might have picked us up. 500 yards farther out and they lose us for sure.
Okay, they can't monitor them all at once.
The XO moved Chicago 1,000 yards before returning to base course. Overhead, they knew, was a Bear F ASW aircraft armed with homing torpedoes and a crew whose job it was to listen to the sonoboy signals. How good were the boys and the men? That was one thing that they didn't know. 3 tense minutes passed, and nothing happened.
All ahead one-third, come left to 3-2-1, the executive officer ordered.
They were now through the line of buoys. 3 more such lines were between them and their target. They'd nearly determined range for 3 of the escorts, but not to the Kirov yet.
Okay, people, the bears are behind us. That's 1 less thing to worry about.
Range to the nearest ship? He asked the approach officer.
26,000 yards. We think he's a Savramani. The Cresta is about 5,000 yards east of him. He's pinging away with hull and VDS sonars.
McCafferty nodded. The variable depth sonar would be below the layer and had scant chance of detecting them. The hull sonar they'd have to pay attention to, but it wouldn't be a problem for a while yet.
Okay, the captain thought, things are going pretty much according to plan.
Con, sonar, torpedoes in the water, bearing 320. Signal faint. Say again, torpedoes in the water, 320. Bearing changing. Additional, lots of active sonars just lit up. We're getting increased screw noise for all contacts.
McCafferty was in the sonar room before the report ended.
Torpedo bearing change?
Yes. Moving left or right.
Jesus, I think somebody's attacking the Russians.
Impact!
The chief jabbed his finger at the display. A series of 3 bright spokes appeared right on the bearing to Kirov. The display suddenly went berserk. The high and medium frequency segment lit up with active sonar lines. The lines indicating ships became brighter as the ships increased engine speeds and changed direction as they began to maneuver.
Secondary explosion on this contact.
Holy shit! Lots of explosions in the water now. Depth charges, maybe. Something's really ripping the water up.
There's another torpedo. Way off, bearing changing right to left.
The display was now too complex for McCafferty to follow. The chief expanded the time scale to allow easier interpretation. But only he and his experienced operators could understand it.
Skipper, it looks like somebody just got inside on them and launched an attack. He got 3 solid hits on Kirov, and now they're trying to beat on him. These 2 ships appear to be converging on something.
Another torpedo in the water, don't know whose.
God, look at all these explosions!
McCafferty went aft.
Periscope depth, now.
Chicago angled upward, taking a minute to reach her position. He saw what might have been a mast on the horizon, and a column of black smoke, bearing 320. Over 20 radars were operating along with a number of voice radios.
Downscope. We have any target solutions?
No, sir, the XO answered.
When they started maneuvering, all our data went to hell.
How far to the next sonoboy line?
2 miles. We're positioned to run right through a gap.
Make your depth 800 feet. Ahead full, move us in.
Chicago's engines sprang into life, accelerating the submarine to 30 knots. The executive officer dived the boat to 800 feet, ducking deep below a sonoboy set for shallow search. McCafferty stood over the chart table, took a pen from his pocket, and unconsciously began chewing on the plastic end as he watched his sub's course take him closer and closer to the enemy formation. Sonar performance dropped virtually to nil with the high speed, but soon the low-frequency sounds of the exploding ordnance echoed through the steel hull. Chicago ran for 20 minutes, zigzagging slightly to avoid the Russian sonoboys, as the fire control men kept updating their solutions.
"Okay, I'll ahead one-third and take her back up to periscope depth," McCafferty said. "Tracking party, stand by for a firing run."
The sonar picture cleared up rapidly. The Soviets were continuing to hunt frantically for whoever had fired at their flagship. One ship's trace was entirely gone. At least one Russian ship had been sunk or crippled. Explosions rippled through the water, punctuated by the screeching sound of homing torpedoes. All were close enough to be a matter of real concern.
"Shooting observation. Upscope."
The search periscope slid upward. McCafferty caught it low and swept the horizon.
Jesus!
The TV monitor showed a bear only half a mile to their right, heading north for the formation. He could see seven ships, mainly mast tops, but one Sovremenny-class destroyer was hull down, perhaps 4 miles away. The smoke he'd seen before was gone. The water resounded with the noise of Russian sonars.
"Raise the radar, power up, and stand by."
A petty officer pushed the button to raise the submarine's surface search radar, activated the system, but kept it in standby mode.
"Energize and give me 2 sweeps, the captain ordered.
There was a real danger here. The Soviets would almost certainly detect the submarine's radar and try to attack it. The radar was on for a total of 12 seconds. It painted a total of 26 targets on the screen, 2 of them close together about where he would have expected Kirov to be. The radar operator read off ranges and bearing, which were entered into the MK-117 fire control director, and relayed to the Harpoon missiles in the torpedo tubes, giving them bearing to target and the range at which to switch on their seeker heads. The weapons officer checked his status lights, then selected the 2 most promising targets for the missiles.
"Set.
Flood tubes." McCafferty watched the weapons panel operator go through the launch sequence. "Opening outer doors."
"Solution checked and valid," the weapons officer said calmly.
"Firing sequence, 1, 2, 3.
"Shoot,"
McCafferty ordered.
"Fire 2.
The submarine shuddered as the powerful impulse of high-pressure air ejected the weapon from the tube, followed by the whoosh of water entering the void.
"Fire 1.
Fire 3.
2, 1, and 3 fired, sir. Torpedo tube doors are shut. Pumping out to reload."
"Reload with Mark 48s. Prepare to fire tomahawks," McCafferty said. The fire control men switched the attack director over to activate the bow-mounted missiles.
"Upscope."
The quartermaster spun the control wheel. McCafferty let it come all the way up. He could see the smoke trail of the last harpoon, and right behind it. McCafferty slapped the periscope handles up and stepped back.
"Helix heading in. Take her down, all ahead flank."
The submarine raced downward. A Soviet anti-sub helicopter had seen the missile launch and was racing in at them.
"Left full rudder."
"Left full rudder, aye. Passing through 100 feet. Speed 15 knots, the XO reported.
"There he is," McCafferty said.
The pings from the helicopter's active sonar reverberated through the hull.
"Reverse your rudder. Shoot off a noisemaker."
The captain ordered his submarine back to an easterly course and reduced speed as they dropped through the layer. With luck, the Soviets would mistake the noisemaker for the cavitation noises of the submarine and attack it as Chicago drew clear.
"Khan, sonar, we have a destroyer heading in bearing 339.
Sounds like a Sovremeny. Torpedo in the water aft. We have one torpedo in the water bearing 265.
Right, 20 degrees rudder. All ahead 2/3. Come to new course 175.
Con, sonar, new contact, twin screws. Just started with a low-frequency sonar, probably a Eudaloy. Blade count says 25 knots, bearing 351 and constant. Torpedo bearing changing, heading aft and fading.
Very well.
McCafferty nodded.
The helicopter dropped on the noisemaker. We don't have to sweat that one. All ahead 1/3, make your depth 1,000 feet.
The Sovremeny he didn't worry too greatly about, but the Eudaloy was another thing entirely. The new Soviet destroyer carried a low-frequency sonar that could penetrate the layer under certain conditions, plus two helicopters and a long-range rocket-boosted torpedo weapon that was better than the American ASROC.
Bawa, the sound of a low-frequency sonar. It had hit them on the first shot. Would it report Chicago's position to the Eudaloy? Or would the submarine's rubber coating prevent it?
Target bearing 351. Blade count is down. Indicates speed of 10 knots, sonar reported.
Okay, he's slowed to search for us.
Sonar, how strong was that ping?
Low edge of detection range, sir. Probably did not get a return off us. Contact is maneuvering, bearing now 353. Continuing to ping, but his sonar is searchlighting west to east away from us. Another helo is pinging, sir, bearing 098. This one's below the layer, but fairly weak.
XO, take us west. We'll try to loop around them to seaward and approach their amphibs from the west.
McCafferty returned to the sonar room. He was tempted to engage the Eudaloy, but could not launch a torpedo this deep without using a dangerously high amount of his reserve high-pressure air. Besides, his job was to kill the command ships, not the escorts. His fire control team set up a solution anyway in case killing the Russian destroyer became a necessity.
God, what a mess, the chief breathed.
The depth charging up north has tapered off some. Bering is steadying down on these contacts here. Either they've resumed their base course or they're heading away. Can't tell which.
Uh-oh, more Sonoboys are dropping down.
The chief's finger traced the new dots in a steady line, heading toward Chicago.
Next one's going to be real close, sir.
McCafferty stuck his head into the attack center.
Bring her around south and go to 2/3.
The next Sonoboy splashed into the water directly overhead. Its cable deployed the transducer below the layer and began automatic pinging.
They got us for sure, Skipper.
McCafferty ordered a course change to the west and again increased to full speed to clear the area. 3 minutes later, a torpedo dropped into the water, either dropped by the Bear or fired from the Eudaloy. They couldn't tell. The torpedo started searching for them from a mile off and turned away. Again, their rubber anechoic coating had saved them. A helo's dipping sonar was detected ahead of them.
McCafferty went south to avoid it, knowing that he was being driven away from the Soviet fleet, but unable to do much about it at the moment. A pair of helicopters was now after him, and for a submarine to defeat two dipping sonars was no simple exercise. It was clear that their mission was not so much to find him as to drive him off, and he could not maneuver fast enough to get past them. After 2 hours of trying, he broke off for the last time. The Soviet force had moved beyond sonar range, their last reported course being southeast toward Anuya.
McCafferty swore to himself. He'd done everything right, gotten through the outer Soviet defenses, and had had a clear idea of how to duck under the destroyer screen. But someone had gotten there first, probably attacked Kirov, his target, and messed everything up for his approach. His three harpoons had probably found targets, unless Ivan had shot them down. But he'd been unable even to monitor their impacts. If they had made impacts. The captain of USS Chicago wrote up his contact report for transmission to Comsublant and wondered why things were going the way they were.
Stornoway, Scotland.
A long way to go, the fighter pilot said.
Yeah, Toland agreed.
Our last report had the group heading southeast to evade a submarine attack. We figure they're back to a southerly course now, but we don't know where they are. The Norwegians sent their last RF-5 in to look, and it disappeared. We have to hit them before they get to Bodø. To hit them, we need to know where they are.
No satellite intel?
Nope.
Okay, I go in with the reconnaissance pod, out and back, 4 hours. I'll need a tanker to top me off about 300 miles out.
No problem, the RAF group captain agreed. Do be careful, we need all your Tomcats to escort the strike tomorrow.
I'll be ready in an hour. The pilot left.
Wish you luck, old boy, the group captain said quietly.
This was the third attempt to locate the Soviet invasion force by air. After the Norwegian reconnaissance aircraft had disappeared, the Brits had tried with a Jaguar. That, too, had vanished. The most obvious solution was to send a Hawkeye with the strike to conduct a radar search, but the Brits weren't letting the E-2s stray too far from their shore. The UK radar stations had taken a fearful pounding, and the Hawkeyes were needed for local defense.
It's not supposed to be this hard, Toland observed.
Here was a golden opportunity to pound the Soviet fleet. Once located, they could strike the force at dawn tomorrow. The NATO aircraft would swoop in with their own air-to-surface missiles. But the extreme range of the mission gave no time for the strike force to loiter around looking. They had to have a target location before they took off. The Norwegians were supposed to have handled this, but NATO plans had not anticipated the virtual annihilation of the Royal Norwegian Air Force in a week's time. The Soviets had enjoyed their only major tactical successes at sea. And they were successes indeed, Toland thought. While the land war in Germany was heading toward a high-technology stalemate, up to now the vaunted NATO navies had been outmaneuvered and outthought by their supposed dullard Soviet adversaries. Taking Iceland had been a masterpiece of an operation. NATO was still scrambling to re-establish the Greenland-Iceland-United Kingdom barrier with submarines that were supposed to have other missions. The Russian backfires were ranging far into the North Atlantic, hitting one convoy a day, and the main Russian submarine force hadn't even gotten there yet. The combination of the two might just close the Atlantic, Toland thought. Then the NATO armies would surely lose, for all their brilliant performance to date. They had to stop the Soviets from taking Bodø in Norway. Once emplaced there, Russian aircraft could attack Scotland, draining resources from the German front and hampering efforts to interdict the bomber forces heading into the Atlantic. Toland shook his head. Once the Russian force was located, they'd pound hell out of it. They had the right weapons, the right doctrine. They could launch their missiles outside the Russian SAM envelopes, just as Ivan was doing to the convoys. It was about time things changed. The tanker lifted off first, followed half an hour later by the fighter. Toland and his British counterpart sat in the intelligence center napping, oblivious to the teletype printer that chattered in the corner. If anything important came in, the junior watch officers would alert them, and senior officers needed their sleep, too.
Huh? Toland started when the man tapped his shoulder.
Coming in, sir. Your Tomcat is arriving, Commander.
The RAF sergeant handed Bob a cup of tea.
15 minutes out. Thought you might wish to freshen up.
Thanks, Sergeant. Toland ran a hand over his unshaven face and decided not to shave. The group captain did, mainly to preserve the look that went with an RAF mustache. The F-14 came in gracefully, its engines idling and wings outstretched, as though grateful for the chance for a landing on something larger than a carrier. The pilot taxied into a hard shelter and quickly dismounted. Technicians were already removing the film cartridge from the camera pod.
"Nothing on their fleet, guys," he said at once.
The radar intercept officer came down behind him.
God, there's fighters up there, the Ryo said. Haven't seen so much activity since the last time we went through aggressor school.
And I got one of the bastards, too. But no joy on the fleet. We covered the coast from Orland to Skagen before we turned back. Not one surface ship visible.
You're certain? The group captain asked.
You can check my film, Captain. No visual sightings, nothing on infrared. No radar emissions, but airborne stuff. Nothing, but lots of fighters. We started finding those just south of Stocky and counted. What was it, Bill?
7 flights, mainly MiG-23s, I think. We never got a visual, but we picked up a lot of Hylark radars. One guy got a little close, and I had to pop him with a Sparrow. We saw the flash. That was a hard kill. In any case, guys, our friends ain't coming to Bodø unless it's by submarine.
You turned back at Skagen.
Ran out of film, and we were low on fuel. The fighter opposition really started picking up north of Bodø. If you want to guess, we need to check out Anuja. But we need something else to do it, SR-71 maybe. I don't think I can get in and out of there except on burner. I'd have to tank right close to there even to try that, and, like I said, lots of fighters were operating there.
Hardly matters, the group captain said. Our aircraft haven't the legs for a strike that far without massive tanker support, and most of our tankers are committed elsewhere.
Chapter 25 Treks Iceland. Once clear of the meadow, they were back in what the map called Wasteland. It was level for the first kilometer. Then the uphill effort began in earnest on the Glimsbrekker, a 700-foot climb.
So soon your legs forget, Edwards thought.
The rain hadn't let up, and the deep twilight they had to guide them forced a slow pace. Many of the rocks they tried to walk on were loose. The footing was treacherous, and a misstep could easily be fatal. Their ankles were sore from the constant twists on the uneven ground, and their tightly laced boots didn't seem to help any more. After 6 days in the back country, Edwards and his Marines were beginning to understand what fatigue was. At each step their knees gave just an inch or so too much, making the next step that much more of an effort. Their pack straps cut cruelly into their shoulders. Their arms were tired from carrying their weapons, and from constantly adjusting their gear. Necks sagged. It was an effort to look up and around, always having to be alert for a possible ambush. Behind them, the glow of the house fire disappeared behind a ridgeline, the first good thing that had happened. No helicopters yet, no vehicles investigating the fire.
Good. But how long would that last?
How soon would the patrol be missed? They all wondered.
All but Vigdis.
Edwards walked a few yards in front of her, listening to her breathing, listening for sobs, wanting to say something to her but not knowing what. Had he done the right thing? Was it murder? Was it expediency? Or was it justice? Did that matter?
So many questions. He set them aside. They had to survive. That mattered.
Take a break, he said. 10 minutes. Sergeant Smith checked to see where the others were, then sat down beside his officer.
"We done good, Lieutenant. I figure 4, maybe 5 miles in the past 2 hours. I think we can ease up a little."
Edwards smiled wanly.
"Why not just stop and build a house here?"
Smith chuckled in the darkness.
"I hear you, Skipper."
The lieutenant studied the map briefly, looking up to see how well it matched with what he could see.
"What say we go left around this marsh? The map shows a waterfall here, the Skulafoss. Looks like a nice deep canyon. Maybe we'll get lucky and find a cave or something. If not, it's deep. No choppers'll come in there, and we'll have shadows to hide in. 5 hours?"
"About that," Smith agreed. "Roads to cross?"
"Nothing shows but foot trails."
"I like it." Smith turned to the girl, who watched them without a word as she sat with her back against a rock.
"How do you feel, ma'am?" he inquired gently.
"Tired."
Her voice said more than that, Edwards thought. There was no emotion there, none at all. He wondered if this was good or bad. What was the right thing to do for the victims of serious crime? Her parents murdered before her eyes, her own body brutally violated. What kind of thoughts were going through that head? Get her mind off it, he decided. "How well do you know this area?" the lieutenant asked.
"My father fish here. I come with him many times."
Her head leaned back into a shadow. Her voice cracked and dropped into quiet sobs. Edwards wanted to wrap an arm around her, to tell her things were all right now. But he was afraid it might only make things worse. Besides, who would believe that things were all right now?
"How we fixed for food, Sarge?" "I figure we got maybe 4 days' worth of canned stuff. I went through the house pretty good, sir," Smith whispered. "Got a pair of fishing rods and some lures. If we take our time, we ought to be able to feed ourselves. Lots of good fish in creeks around here, maybe at this place we're going. Salmon and trout. Never could afford to do it myself, but I heard tell that the fishing's really something. You said your daddy's a fisherman, right?"
"Lobsterman. Close enough."
"You said you couldn't afford—"
"Lieutenant, they charge you like $200 a day to fish up here," Smith explained.
"Hard to afford on a sergeant's pay, you know. But if they charge that much, there must be a shitload of fish in the water, right?"
"Sounds reasonable," Edwards agreed. "Time to move. When we get to that mountain, we'll belly up for a while and get everybody rested."
"I'll drink to that, Skipper. Might make us late getting to—"
"Screw it. Then we're late. The rules just changed some. Ivan's liable to be looking for us. We take it slow from now on. If our friends on the other end of this radio don't like it, too damn bad. We'll get there late, but we'll get there."
"You got it, Skipper. Garcia, take the point. Rogers, cover the back door. 5 more hours, Marines, then we sleep."
USS Farris. The spray stung his face, and Morris loved it. The convoy of ballasted ships was steaming into the teeth of a 40-knot gale. The sea was an ugly, foam-whipped shade of green, droplets of seawater tearing off the white caps to fly horizontally through the air. His frigate climbed up the steep face of endless 20-foot swells, then crashed down again in a succession that had lasted 6 hours. The ship's motion was brutal. Each time the bow nosed down, it was as though the brakes had been slammed on a car. Men held on to stanchions and stood with their feet wide apart to compensate for the continuous motion. Those in the open, like Morris, wore life preservers and hooded jackets. A number of his young crewmen would be suffering from this, ordinarily. Even professional sailormen wanted to avoid this sort of weather. But now, mainly, they slept. Farris was back to normal condition 3 steaming, and that allowed the men to catch up on their rest. Weather like this made combat nearly impossible. Submarines were mainly a one-sensor platform. For the most part, they detected targets on sonar, and the crashing sea noise tended to blanket the ship sounds submarines listened for. A really militant sub-skipper could try running at periscope depth to operate his search radar, but that meant running the risk of broaching and momentarily losing control of his boat, not something a nuclear submarine officer looked kindly upon. A submarine would practically have to ram a ship to detect it, and the odds against that were slim. Nor did they have to worry about air attacks for the present. The sea's crenellated surface would surely confuse the seeker head of a Russian missile. For their own part, their bow-mounted sonar was useless, as it heaved up and down in a 20-foot arc, sometimes rising completely clear of the water. Their towed array sonar trailed in the placid waters a few hundred feet below the surface, and so could theoretically function fairly well. But in practice, a submarine had to be moving at high speed to stand out from the violent surface noise, and even then engaging a target under these conditions was no simple matter. His helicopter was grounded,
Taking off might have been possible, but landing was a flat impossibility under these conditions. A submarine would have to be within ASROC torpedo range, 5 miles, to be in danger from the frigate. But even that was a slim possibility. They could always call in a P-3 Orion. 2 were operating with the convoy at present. But Morris did not envy their crews a bit, as they buffeted through the clouds at under 1,000 feet. For everyone, a storm meant time off from battle, for both sides to rest up for the next round. The Russians would have it easier. Their long-range aircraft would be down for needed maintenance, and their submarines, cruising 400 feet down, could keep their sonar watches in comfort.
Coffee, skipper?
Chief Clark came out of the pilot house, a cup in his hand with a saucer on top to keep the salt water out.
Thanks.
Morris took the cup and drained half of it.
How's the crew doing?
Too tired to barf, sir, Clark laughed, sleeping like babies.
How much longer this slop gonna last, Cap'n?
12 more hours, then it's supposed to clear off. High-pressure system right behind this.
The long-range weather report had just come in from Norfolk. The storm track was moving farther north. Mostly clear weather for the next 2 weeks.
Wonderful.
The chief leaned outboard to see how the forward deck fittings were taking the abuse. Every third or fourth wave, Ferris dug her nose in hard, occasionally taking green water over the bow. This water slammed into things, and the chief's job was to get them fixed. Like most of the 1052s assigned to the Stormy Atlantic, Ferris had been given spray strakes and higher bow plating on her last overhaul, which reduced but did not entirely eliminate the problem known to sailors since men first went to sea. The ocean will try very hard to kill you if you lack the respect she demands. Clark's trained eye took in 100 details before he turned back.
Looks like she's riding this one out okay.
Hell, I'd settle for this all the way back, Morris said after finishing off his coffee. After it's over, we'll have to round up a lot of merchies, though. Clark nodded agreement. Station keeping was not especially easy in this kind of weather.
So far, so good, Captain.
Nothing big has come loose yet.
How about the tail?
No sweat, sir. I got a man keeping an eye on that. Should hold up nice, unless we have to speed up. Both men knew they wouldn't speed up. They were making 10 knots, and the frigate couldn't run much faster than that in these seas, no matter what the cause.
Heading aft, sir.
Okay, heads up.
Morris looked aloft to check that his lookouts were still alert. Probabilities or not, there was danger out there. All kinds.
Stornoway, Scotland. Anoya. They weren't heading for Bodø after all, Toland said as he pored over the satellite photographs of Norway.
How many troops on the ground, do you think?
At least a brigade group, Captain.
Maybe a short division. Lots of tracked vehicles here, lots of SAMs, too. They're already basing fighters at the airfield.
Be bombers next.
Maybe there by now.
These shots are 3 hours old.
The Russian naval force was already headed back to the Kola Fjord. They could reinforce by air now. He wondered what had happened to the regiment of Norwegians supposed to be based there.
Their blinder light bombers can reach us from there. Bastards can dash in and out at high-mark numbers, be bloody difficult to intercept.
The Soviets had launched a systematic attack on the RAF radar stations arrayed on the Scottish coast. Some attacks were by air-to-surface missiles, others by submarine-launched cruise missiles. One had even been by fighter bombers with massive jamming support. But that one had been costly. RAF Tornadoes had killed half of the raiders, mainly on the return leg. Twin-engine blinder bombers could deliver their heavy bomb loads after running in low and fast.
Probably why Ivan wanted Anoya, Toland thought. Perfectly located for them. Easy to support from their own northern bases, and just a little too far for fighter bombers in Scotland to